We didn't use that word, but there was a disagreement. The scientists and the engineers, against the command staff and the Marines. The thing is, none of them could make the engines work. Only Mother could do that. She chose this place and brought us here. Detritus. But it was too far, too difficult. She died from the effort, Spencer. Our ships were damaged while landing, the engines broken. But we also lost her, the soul of the engines themselves. I remember crying. I remember Father carrying me from the rubble of a ship, and I screamed, reaching back to the smoking hulk, my mother's tomb. I remember demanding to know why Mother had left us. I felt betrayed. I'd been too young to understand the choice she'd made. A warrior's choice. To die? To sacrifice, Spencer. A warrior is nothing if she has nothing to fight for. But if she has everything to fight for, well, then that means everything, doesn't it? Gran-Gran strung a bead, then began to tie off the necklace. I felt strangely exhausted, like this story was a burden I hadn't been expected to bear. This is their defect, Gran-Gran said. They call it that because they're afraid of our ability to hear the stars. Your mother always forbade me from speaking of this to you because she did not believe it was true. But many in the DDF believe in it, and to them it makes us alien. They lie, saying that my mother brought us here because the Krell wanted us here. And now that they no longer need us to work the ship engines, because there aren't any, they've hated us even more. And Father? I saw him turn against his flight. Impossible, Gran-Gran said. The DDF claims our gift makes us monsters, so perhaps they constructed a scenario to prove it. It's convenient for them to tell a story of a man with the defect empathizing with the Krell and turning against his teammates. I sat back feeling uncertain. Would Cobb have lied about this? And Embot said the record couldn't have been faked. Who did I trust? But what if it's true, Gran-Gran? I asked. You mentioned the warrior's sacrifice before. Well, what if you know this is in you? That it might cause you to betray everyone, hurt them? If you think you might be a coward, wouldn't the right choice be to just not fly? Gran-Gran paused, hands frozen. You've grown, she finally said. Where is my little girl, who wanted to swing a sword and conquer the world? She's very confused, a bit lost. Our gift is a wonderful thing. It lets us hear the stars. It let my mother work the engines. Don't fear it. I nodded, but I couldn't help feeling betrayed. Shouldn't someone have told me about all this before now? Your father was a hero, Gran-Gran said. Spencer, do you hear me? You have a gift, not a defect. You can hear the stars. Yes, I felt that. I looked up, but the ceiling of the cavern was in the way. Honestly, I didn't know what to think anymore. Coming down here had only made me more confused. Spencer, Gran-Gran said. I shook my head. Father told me to claim the stars. I worry that they claimed him instead. Thank you for the story. I rose and walked to the ladder. Spencer, Gran-Gran said, this time with a forcefulness that froze me on the ladder. She looked toward me, milky white eyes focused right on me, and I felt, somehow, that she could see me. When she spoke, the tremble was gone from her voice. Instead, there was an authority and command to it, like a battlefield general's. If we are ever to leave this planet, Gran-Gran said, and escape the Krell, it will require the use of our gift. The space between stars is vast, too vast for any ordinary booster to travel. We must not catch. cower in the dark because we're afraid of the spark within us. The answer is not to put out the spark, but to learn to control it.
I didn't reply, because I didn't know what my answer to that should be. I climbed down, made my way to the elevators, and returned to the base. Chapter 46.
Verbal confirmations in ascending order, said Nose, the flight leader of Nightmare Flight. Newbies first.
Skyward One, ready,
Jorgen said, then hesitated. He sighed.
Call sign Jerkface.
Nose chuckled.
I feel your pain, cadet.
FM sounded off, then I followed. Skyward Flight, what was left of it, was flying with Nightmare today on their maneuvers. I hadn't made any decisions about what to do with the information Gran-Gran had given me. I was still deeply troubled, uncertain. For now, though, I had decided to do what Jorgen told me and keep flying. I could avoid what had happened to my father, right? I could be careful. I flew through the maneuvers that Nightmare Flight Leader instructed, letting the familiar motions distract me. It was nice to be back in a Poco-class ship after several weeks of testing other designs. It felt like settling into a familiar, easy chair, imprinted with just the right dents from your backside. We flew in a wide formation, Jorgen paired with a member of Nightmare Flight, down at 10K altitude. We were spotting the ground for wrecks, trails of ships in the dust, and anything else suspicious. It was akin to scouting during a battle, but, if possible, even more monotonous.
Unidentified signature at 53-1-8008, said one of the men from Nightmare Flight. We should—
Cobb warned us about the 8008 trick, Jorgen said flatly. And about the get the green pilot to evacuate his ship septic trick. And about the prepare for inspection joke.
Scud, said one of the other pilots. Old Cobb really is no fun, is he?
Because he doesn't want his cadets getting hazed, Jorgen said.
We are supposed to be watching for signs of Krell, not engaging in juvenile initiation rituals. I expected better of you men and women.
I glanced out my cockpit toward FM, who shook her head. Oh, Jorgen.
Jerkface, eh? Said one of the pilots.
I can't imagine where you'd get a name like that.
Enough chit-chat, Nose said, cutting off individual channels. Everyone make for 53.8-702-45,000. Home radar shows some turbulence in the debris field above that point.
A few grumbles met that, which I found curious. I'd imagined full pilots as being, well, more dignified. Maybe that was Jorgen's influence on me. We flew the indicated heading, and ahead, a large-scale debris fall began to occur. Chunks of metal rained down, some as bright lines of fire and smoke. Others, with acclivity rings or still-charged acclivity stone, hovering down more slowly. We carefully approached the edge of the debris fall.
All right, Nose said. We're supposed to be showing these cadets some maneuvers. While we watch for Krell, let's do some runs through the debris. If you spot a good acclivity ring, tag it with a radio beacon for salvage. Bog and Tombstone, you're up first. Local heading 83. Take the two cadets on your tail. Sushi and Nord, you take heading 17 and take Jerkface. Maybe he can lecture you on proper procedure. Stars know you boneheads could use it.
FM and I followed the full pilots, who did a very cautious and somewhat unengaging pass through the debris. We didn't even use our light lances. Bog, the man who had made fun of Jorgen earlier, shot a few radio beacons at some larger chunks of debris.
Is your flight leader always like that? He asked us, talking like he's got his joystick rammed up his backside.
Jorgen is a great flight leader, I snapped. You shouldn't resent someone just because he expects you to do your best.
Yeah, FM said. If you're going to swear to a cause, no matter how fundamentally flawed, then you should try to uphold your office.
Scud, Bog said. You hearing this, Tombstone?
I hear a bunch of yapping puppies on the line,
Tombstone replied. Her voice was high-pitched and dismissive.
They keep drowning out the cadets, unfortunately.
You should be careful, I said, my anger rising. Next week, we'll be full pilots, and I'll be competing with you for kills.
Good luck making ace once that happens.
Bog chuckled.
A few days from full pilot? My, how grown up you are.
He hit his booster and darted back into the falling debris, Tombstone on his wing. FM and I followed, watching as Bog went in close to a falling chunk of debris, then used his light lance to pivot around it. It was a competent pivot, but nothing special. He followed it by pivoting around another piece of junk, which he tagged for salvage. Tombstone followed, though she ended up overshooting her second piece of debris as she pivoted too sharply. FM and I followed at a modest distance, watching them, until FM said on a direct call,
Spin! I think they're trying to show off.
Nah, I said. Those were some basic pivots. Surely they don't think we would be impressed by that. I trailed off as Bog's comline lit up.
That's called light lancing, kids. They might be graduating you, but you'll still have a lot to learn.
I looked out toward FM, incredulous. I knew, logically, that most cadets focused on dogfighting and destructor play. Cobb said it was part of the DDF's problem, churning out pilots with a focus on maximizing kills rather than flight prowess. But even knowing that, I was shocked. These pilots really expected us to be awed by maneuvers Cobb had taught during our first weeks in flight school? 214, I said to FM. With a double flatline at the end and a V-sweep?
Gladly,
she said, and hit her overburn. The two of us zipped out and then pivoted in opposite directions around a large chunk of debris. I swung myself around a second burning chunk, zipping down beneath it, then flinging myself upward so I launched into the sky, acclivity ring hinging backward. I spun between two larger debris chunks and tagged them both, before pivoting around the higher one to dive back downward. FM was coming up straight at me. I hit her with a light lance, then turned and overburned opposite her. The two of us expertly spun each other in the air, conserving momentum. My grav caps flashed right as I let us out of the maneuver. After the twist, she rocketed out heading east, and I launched out heading west. We each tagged a piece of debris, then swept around together, rejoining Bog and Tombstone, who didn't say anything. I followed them in silence, grinning, until another light on my comm flashed.
You two looking for a flight when you graduate?
Nose asked.
We've got a couple of holes.
We'll see, FM said. I might become a scout. Life in this flight seems kind of boring.
You two been showing off?
Jorgen's voice cut in over a private channel as he flew back with his wingmate. Would we do that? I asked him.
Spin, he said. You could be tied to a table with 8 broken ribs and a delirious fever, and you'd still find a way to make everyone else look bad.
Hey, I said, grinning at the compliment. Most people make themselves look bad. I just stand to the side and don't get in the way. Jorgen chuckled.
On my last pass, I saw something flash up above. Might be Krell. Let me see if Nose will let us go check it out.
There you go again, FM said, always being a jerkface and actually remembering our orders. Such a terrible example, I said. He called into Nose and started gaining altitude.
Spin and FM, you're with me. We've got clearance to climb to 700K to scope it out. But be careful. We haven't practiced a lot of minimal atmosphere maneuverability.
Starships could, of course, fly just fine without atmosphere, but it was a different kind of flight. At the same time, I found myself nervous as we climbed higher and higher. This was even higher than I'd gone in MBOT, and I kept thinking about what had happened when my father had climbed up near the debris field. I still didn't know what had changed up there to make him fight his own team. Scud. Maybe I should stay down low. It was too late now, though, as the general haze of shapes that made up the debris field became increasingly distinct. Getting closer, I could see skylights looming at the lower levels of the debris, and my mind reeled at their scale. We were still 100 clicks from them, and they looked enormous. How big were those? timid. I tried to see if I could hear the stars better, up this close. I focused, and I thought I heard faint sounds coming from up there, but they were obstructed, as if something was in the way. The debris field, I thought. It is interfering. My father had only turned traitor after he'd seen a hole in the debris field, an alignment that let him see out into space. And maybe fly all the way through the debris field to get out himself? There, FM said, drawing my attention back to our mission. At my seven, something big. The light shifted, and I saw a gargantuan shape among the broken bits of debris. Large, boxy, it was somehow familiar. That looks a lot like the old shipyard that I chased Ned into, I said.
Yeah, Jorgen said. And it's in a low orbit. Might crash down in a few days at that rate. Maybe all of those old shipyards have started running out of power.
Which means, FM said.
Hundreds of acclivity rings, Jorgen finished. If this thing falls, and we can salvage it, it could transform the DDF. I'll call in a report.
Distant light flashed along one side of the enormous shipyard. Those were destructors, I said.
Something is shooting up there. Don't get too close.
I hit the mute, then scrambled for my personal radio. Embot, you seeing this? Any guess what that shipyard is firing at?
Silence.
Right. Embot was gone. Please, I whispered into the radio. I need you. Silence. I blushed, feeling foolish, then clipped the private radio back into its spot on my seat where it wouldn't rattle around the cockpit.
That is curious, Jorgen, Cobb was saying as I turned off the mute. Those destructor blasts are probably defense turrets on the shipyard itself. The one that fell earlier had them, though they were out of power by that point. Report this back to Nose, and I'll take it to Flight Command. If that thing drops, we'll want to salvage it before the Krell destroy it.
Cobb, I said, it's still firing.
Yeah,
he answered.
So Jorgen said.
At what, though? I asked. Up above, black specks resolved into Krell ships, which had likely been scouting the old shipyard's perimeter. But now, they saw us. Chapter 47. We bolted down from the outer atmosphere.
Krell flight on our tail, Jorgen radioed in. Repeat, we have a full flight of Krell, perhaps 20 ships chasing us. What have you fool cadets done?
Nose asked.
Jorgen didn't defend us as I would have. Sorry, sir, he said instead. Orders? Each of you break off with a pair of experienced pilots. I'll put you with-
Sir,
Jorgen interrupted.
I'd rather fly with my flight, if you allow it.
Fine, fine, Nose said, then cursed as the Krell appeared out of the upper atmosphere. Just stay alive. Nightmare flight, all ships go into evasive posturing. Draw their attention and watch for lifebusters. Riptide flight is only a few clicks away. We should have reinforcements in short order.
Spin, your point,
Jorgen said, switching to our private flight channel.
You heard our orders. No showboating. No kill chasing. Defensive postures until reinforcements arrive.
Gotcha, I said, and FM did likewise. We fell into a triangle position, and immediately 5 Krell swarmed in our direction. I sent us diving to a lower altitude, then pivoted up using a large, mostly stationary chunk of debris. We swooped around, then flew back through the middle of the Krell who were trying to follow. They scattered.
You call that defensive spin?
Jorgen asked.
Did I shoot at any?
You were going to.
I moved my thumb off the trigger. Spoil sport. The skylight above dimmed and flickered off as the night cycle began. My canopy had good enough dark vision to lighten the battlefield, but a certain gloom fell on it. Darkness punctured by red destructors and the glow of boosters. The 3 of us stayed together, swooping and dodging through the mess as Riptide flight arrived.
2 more flights of reinforcements are nearby,
Jorgen told us.
Waiting in case one of these debris falls contained enemies. We should have good numbers soon. Hold defensive postures for now.
We confirmed and FM took point. Unfortunately, right as she was moving into position, a group of Krell came in at us firing. Our defensive maneuvers sent Jorgen and me cutting in one direction and FM in the other. I gritted my teeth, falling in behind Jorgen as we overburned and swung around a piece of debris, chasing after the two Krell who were now on FM's tail. Destructors flashed around her as she spun, taking at least two hits to her shield.
FM, cut right at my mark, Jorgen said. Spin, be ready.
We obeyed, moving as a well-practiced machine. FM swung around a piece of debris while Jorgen and I performed rotating boosts, so we launched sideways to intersect her path. I fell back while Jorgen hit his IMP, then I fired, hitting one Krell and knocking it into a spinning descent. The other cut away from us, fleeing. I caught Jorgen with my light lance, and we used our momentum together to turn us after FM, who slowed down and fell in with us. The two of us then took a defensive position around Jorgen, who quickly reignited his shield. It was over before I had time to think about what we'd just done. Hours upon hours of practice had made it second nature. Victorious warriors win first and then go to war, Sun Tzu had said. I was barely starting to understand what that meant. From what I could judge of the battle, our numbers were roughly even with the Krell, who had been joined by more ships from above. That made me want to go on the offensive, but I stayed in formation, dodging Krell fire and leading groups of them on difficult chases around and through the fighting. I focused on the battle until, from the corner of my eye, I spotted something. A larger ship, just behind a slow-moving chunk of debris. Again, I hadn't been looking for it specifically, but my brain, trained and practiced by now, picked it out anyway. Is that a lifebuster? I said to the others.
Scud, Jorgen said. Flight command, we've got a lifebuster. 53.1-689-12000. Falling with an oblong piece of debris that I am marking right now with a radio tag.
Confirmed,
a cold voice said on the line. Ironsides herself. She rarely spoke to us directly, though she often listened to the chatter.
Pull back from that position. Act as if you haven't seen it.
Admiral, I said, I can hit it, and we're out well beyond where a blast would be dangerous to Alta.
Let me bring it down.
Negative, cadet, Ironside said.
Pull back.
Flashes in my memory returned to the day Bim had died. My hand felt stiff on the control sphere, but I yanked it forcibly to the side, following Jorgen and FM away from the lifebuster. It was surprisingly hard, as if my ship itself wanted to disobey.
Well done, Spin, Cobb said over a private line. You have the passion. Now you're showing restraint. We'll make a real pilot of you yet.
Thank you, sir, I said. But the lifebuster,
Ironsides knows what she's doing.
We fell back, and other flights were ordered higher into the sky. The battlefield changed shape as the lifebuster, seemingly ignored, got close to the ground and started toward Alta. I tracked it, nervous, until four aces from Riptide Flight detached and swarmed after it. They would engage it far enough away from the main fight to protect the rest of us if the bomb detonated. If they failed, then the soon-arriving reinforcements would catch the lifebuster. Our trio of ships picked up some tails, so I had to dodge to avoid heavy fire. The entire pack of Krell followed me, but a second later, Jorgen and FM swooped in and drove them off. FM even got a kill, overwhelming a shield without needing the IMP.
Nice, I said, relaxing from the sudden intense burst of flying.
And thank you. Off in the distance, the aces had engaged the lifebuster. Like before, in the flight with Bim, a group of smaller ships had detached from the bomber and were protecting it.
Cobb, I said, hitting the comm. Have you learned anything about those ships that travel with the lifebuster?
Not much, Cobb said. It's newer behavior, but they've been appearing with all bombers recently. The aces will deal with them. Keep your attention on your flight, Spin.
Yes, sir.
I still couldn't help watching the fight for the lifebuster. If it blew, We'd have to be ready to overburn away before its sequence of explosions completed. So I was relieved when eventually, the lifebuster and its escort pulled up into the sky, retreating. The Aces gave token chase, but eventually let the bomb escape back up where it had come from. I smiled.
Mayday! A voice called on the general line. This is Bog. Shields down. Wingmate down. Please, someone.
55.5-699-4000, FM said. And I looked toward the coordinates, spotting a beleaguered Poco trailing smoke and fleeing outward, away from the main battlefield. Four Krell followed. The best way to get yourself killed was to let them isolate you, but Bog clearly didn't have a choice.
Skyward flight here, Bog, Jorgen said, taking point. We have you. Hold on and try to bear left.
We stormed after him and fired at will on Jorgen's order. Our hailstorm of destructor fire didn't bring down any enemy ships, but it made most of them scatter. Three went left, which would cut Bog off. Jorgen turned after those, and FM followed him.
There's still one on his tail, I said. I'll take it. All right, Jorgen said with a moment's pause. He obviously hated splitting the flight.
I fell in after the ship. Straight ahead, Bog was going through increasingly crazy maneuvers, reckless ones, to avoid being hit.
Shoot it, he screamed. Please shoot it! Just shoot it!
Desperation, frantic worry, things I hadn't expected of a full pilot. Of course, he looked young. Though it should have occurred to me earlier, I realized he'd probably graduated in one of the classes right before mine. 6 months, maybe a year as a pilot. But still an 18-year-old boy. I picked up two tails that concentrated fire on me. Scud. Bog had led our chase so far out, it was going to be hard to pick up support. I didn't dare IMP. Not with destructors flashing around me. But that Krell ahead of me still had a shield up. I gritted my teeth, then hit my overburn. G-forces pressed me back in my seat, and I got closer to the Krell, sticking to its tail, barely able to dodge. I'd hit Mag 3, and at this speed, flight maneuvers were going to be difficult to control. Just a second longer. I got in close and speared the Krell ship with my light lance. Then I turned, pulling the Krell ship out of line with Bog. The cockpit trembled around me as my captive Krell cut in the other direction, fighting me, sending us both into a frantic, out-of-control spin. My tails turned and concentrated fire on me. They didn't care if they hit the ship I had lanced. Krell never cared about that. A storm of fire swallowed me, hitting my shield and drilling it down. The Krell ship I'd speared exploded under fire from its allies, and I was forced to pull into a sharp climb on full overburn to try to get away. That was a risky move. My grav caps cut out, and the G-force hit like a kick to the face. It pulled me downward, forced the blood into my feet. My flight suit inflated, pushing against my skin, and I did my breathing exercises as trained. My vision still blackened at the edges, flashing lights on my console. My shield was down. I cut my acclivity ring, spun on my axis, then overburned right back downward. The grav caps managed to absorb some of the whiplash, but a human body simply wasn't meant to handle that kind of reversal. I felt sick, and almost threw up as I passed through the middle of the Krell. My hands were trembling on the controls, my vision growing red this time. Most of the Krell didn't respond in time, but one of them, one ship, managed to spin on its own axis as I had. It focused on me, then fired. A flash on my wing. An explosion. I'd been hit. Beeps screamed at me from my console. Lights flashed. My control sphere suddenly didn't seem to do anything, going slack as I tried to maneuver. The cockpit rocked, and the world rotated as my ship started spiraling out of control.
Spin!
I somehow heard Jorgen shout over the chaos of the beeping,
Eject, Spin! You're going down!
Eject. You weren't supposed to be able to think during moments like these. It was all supposed to happen in a flash. And yet, that second seemed frozen to me. My hand, hovering as it reached for the eject lever between my legs. The world a spinning blur. My wing gone. My ship on fire. My acclivity ring unresponsive. A moment frozen between life and death. And hurl in the back of my head. Brave to the end, not cowards. A pact. I would not eject. I could steer this ship down. I was no coward. I was not afraid to die. And what will it do to them? Something else within me asked. If you do, what would it do to my flight to lose me? What would it do to Cobb, to my mother? Screaming, I grabbed the eject lever and yanked hard. My canopy exploded off, and my seat blasted out into the sky. I woke to silence and wind brushing against my face. My seat lay on the dusty ground, and I faced the sky. The parachute flapped behind me. I could hear the wind playing with it. I had blacked out. I lay there, staring upward. Red streaks in the distance. Explosions. Blossoms of orange light. Just faint pops from this far down. I shifted to the side. What was left of my Poco burned in the near distance, destroyed. My future. My life burned away with it. I lay there until the battle ended, the Krell retreating. Jorgen did a flyby to check if I was all right, and I waved to him to allay his worry. By the time a rescue transport came for me, lowering silently on its acclivity ring, I had unbuckled. My radio and my canteen had survived the ejection, attached to my seat. I had used one to call in and drank from the other. A medic had me sit on a seat in the transport, then inspected me while a member of the survey corps walked out and looked over the wreckage of my Poco. The salvage woman eventually walked back, holding a clipboard. Well? I asked softly. In-seat grav caps kept you from smashing your own spine, the medic said. You seem to have only minimal whiplash, unless there's a pain you're not telling me about. I didn't mean me. I looked at the salvage woman. Then over at my Poco. The acclivity ring is destroyed, she said. Not much to salvage. That was what I'd been afraid of. I strapped into the transport seat, then looked out the window as it took off. I watched the burning light of my Poco's fire fade, then vanish. At last we landed at Alta, and I climbed out of the vehicle, stiff, body aching. I limped across the tarmac. Somehow I knew. Before I even saw her face, that one of the figures standing in the darkness beside the landing site would be Admiral Ironsides. Of course she had come. She finally had a real excuse to kick me out. And could I blame her, now that I knew what I did? I stopped in front of her and saluted. She, remarkably, saluted me back. Then she unpinned my cadet's pin from my uniform. I didn't cry. Honestly, I was too tired, and my head hurt too much. Ironsides turned the pin over in her fingers. Sir, I said. She handed my pin back. Cadet Spencer Nightshade, you are dismissed from flight school. By tradition, as a cadet who was shot down soon before graduation, you'll be added to the list of possible pilots to call up should we have extra ships. Those possible pilots could be summoned by the Admiral's order only. It would never happen to me. You can keep your pin, Ironsides added. Wear it with pride, but return your other gear to the quartermaster by 1200 tomorrow. Then without another word, she turned and left. I held a second salute until she was out of sight, pin gripped in the fingers of my other hand. It was over. I was done. Skyward Flight would graduate only two members after all. Part 5. Interlude. That is one problem handled, thought Judy Ironsides Ivins as she walked away from the launch pad. Rakulfer, her aide-de-camp, hurried along beside her, holding his ever-present clipboard full of things Judy needed to do.
At the door to her command building, she looked over her shoulder. Chaser's daughter, the defect, held her salute, then pressed her cadet's pin against her chest. Judy felt a small spike of guilt, then pushed her way into flight command. "I fought that fight," she thought, "and bear the battle scars." The last time she'd ignored the defect, she'd been forced to watch a friend go crazy and kill his flight mates. This was a good outcome. The girl would get some honor, as she was due for her passion. And Judy now had some data about the brains of people with the defect. She had to give credit to Cobb's scheme for that. If he hadn't forced her to let the child into the DDF, Judy would never have had that opportunity. Now, fortunately, she had a solid, traditional reason for never putting Chaser's daughter in a fighter again. And she could watch each new cadet for signs of the defect. This was actually an ideal outcome in every possible way. If only other problems could be dealt with so easily. Judy approached a small conference room, then stopped, looking at Rakulfer. "Are they here?" "NAL Wait is in attendance," Rakulfer said, "as are NALs Mendez and Ukrit." That was three National Assembly leaders. Normally, they sent underlings to these post-battle briefings, but Judy had been expecting a larger confrontation for some time. She would need something to give them, a plan. "Have the radio technicians confirmed the existence of that shipyard the scouts spotted tonight?" Rakulfer handed her a sheet of paper. "It's too far for traditional scanners, but we've been able to send up a science ship to investigate from a safe distance. The shipyard is there, and the scientists are optimistic. If it's like the other one, and if we can protect it from the Krell, we could recover hundreds of acclivity rings." She nodded, reading the statistics. "The orbit is decaying rapidly, sir," Rakulfer noted. "The old shipyard seems to be suffering a severe power failure. Scientists guess the proximity guns will stop firing in a couple of days, right about the time it drops into the atmosphere. The Krell will undoubtedly try to get in and destroy it."
"Then we'll have to prevent that," Judy said.
"Anything else I need to know?"
"This many assembly leaders? It smells of an ambush, sir. Be prepared."
She nodded, put on her political face, and strode into the small room, Rakulfer following. A collection of the most powerful people in the lower caverns waited for her, each of them wearing a military dress uniform and pins indicating their merits.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "I'm pleased to see you taking a direct interest in—"
"Dispense with the platitudes, Ironsides," said Algernon Waite, young Jorgen's father.
The stiff, graying man sat at the head of the conference table, opposite Judy.
"You lost more ships tonight."
"We have successfully scared away a lifebuster, scoring a great victory over—"
"You're driving the DDF into the ground,"
Waite said.
"During your tenure," Ukrit added, "our reserve of ships has fallen to historic lows. I hear that broken fighters are just sitting in hangars, lacking parts for repair."
"Your pilot casualty rates are terrible," Valda Mendez said. She was a petite woman with tan skin. Ironsides had flown with her once upon a time.
"We want to know what your plan is for ending the DDF's spiral of failure."
"It would help," Judy thought, "if you would stop taking our best pilots away." Valda herself seemed completely unashamed of stealing her son from the DDF to keep him out of battle. But Judy couldn't say that. She couldn't explain how desperate the DDF was, now that the better admirals and commanders were dead. She couldn't explain how she'd foreseen this years ago, and no amount of scraping and scrambling had been able to prevent the descent. She couldn't explain that her people were overworked, and that their morale was crumbling beneath so many losses and pilot casualties. She couldn't say any of that because, although it was true, it was no excuse. Her job was to offer a solution, a miracle. She held up one of the sheets Rakulfer had given her.
"Lanchester's Law," she said. "Do you know it?"
"Equal armies of soldiers, with equal skill, will impose equivalent casualties upon each other," Waite said. "But the larger the imbalance in troops, the more disproportionate the casualties. Essentially, the more you outnumber your enemy, the less damage you can expect each of their soldiers to impose.
The bigger your numerical odds, Valda said, the fewer people you lose.
Judy handed the page to the group.
This, she said, is a scout report with initial scientific analysis of a large piece of salvage that should crash down in 2 days. The Krell never field more than 100 ships at once. But if we can salvage this shipyard, we can top that.
Hundreds of potential acclivity rings, Valda said, reading the report. You think you can do it? Salvage this?
I think we have no other choice, Judy said. Until we can field more ships than the Krell, we'll be fighting a losing battle.
If we can stop them from destroying that shipyard as it falls, it might be just what we need. The report says it will crash down on graduation day, Ukrit said with a grunt. Looks like it will be a short ceremony.
Let's be clear, Waite said.
Ivans, what are you proposing?
We must capture this piece of salvage, Judy said. We have to be ready to throw everything we have at protecting it. As soon as its orbit starts to degrade, and its proximity guns run out of power, we have to destroy every Krell ship that tries to get close to it.
Bold, Ukrit said. They won't let that salvage go easily, Rakolfer said, looking toward the others. If they don't retreat, we won't be able to either. We could end up engaged in a battle where our every ship is committed. If we lose, it will leave us devastated.
It will be a second Battle of Alta,
Waite said softly.
All or nothing.
I fought in the Battle of Alta, Ironside said, and I know the risks involved in such an engagement. But frankly, we're out of options. Either we try this, or we waste away. Can I count on your support for this proposal?
One at a time, the assembly leaders nodded. They knew as well as she did. The time to make a stand was when you were still strong enough to possibly win. Just like that, they were committed.
Stars help us all, Judy thought.
Chapter 48. I attended the graduation. I stood in the audience with everyone else, on the parade ground beside the statue park inside Alta Base. On a wooden stage, Ironsides pinned each of the 8 graduates with the symbol of their success. I hung near the back of the small crowd, among a few other people wearing cadets' pins. People who had washed out, like me. Though we couldn't fly, our pins would get us access to the elevators whenever we wanted, and we were invited to functions like this. I'd gotten a form letter from Ironsides. My emotions were complicated as I watched Jorgen and FM, in turn, accept their pins. I was certainly proud of them, and deeply envious, while somewhat ashamedly relieved at the same time. I didn't know if I could be trusted to be up on that stand. This solved the problem. I didn't have to decide. Deep in my heart, though, my world was crumbling. To never fly again? Could I live knowing that? Jorgen and FM saluted with gloved hands while wearing new, crisp white uniforms. I clapped with the rest of the crowd for the 8 graduates, but I couldn't help thinking that we'd lost at least 3 times that many ships in the last 4 months. Not so long ago, a good pilot in the DDF could fly for 5 years, rack up a couple dozen kills, and retire to fly cargo. But casualties were getting worse and worse, and fewer pilots lasted 5 years. The Krell were winning, slowly but surely. Ironside stepped up to speak.
Normally, you'd expect a bad speech from me right now. It's practically tradition. But we have an operation today of some importance, so I'm going to leave it at a few words. These behind me represent our best. They are our pride, the symbol of our defiance. We will not hide. We will not back down. We will reclaim our homeland in the stars. And it starts today.
More applause, though I gathered, from conversations around me, that
that such a brief speech was odd. As some refreshments were set up on tables to our right, the Admiral and her command staff walked away without mingling. More strangely, the newly commissioned pilots followed her. I craned my neck and saw a flight of fighters shoot up into the air from a nearby launch pad. Was there an incursion happening? Did they really need all the graduates? After spending the last few days down with my mother and Gran-Gran, I had been looking forward to seeing Jorgen and FM again. Boom sounded in the distance as the fighters got a safe distance from the base, then hit overburn and accelerated past the sound barrier. A nearby man noted that the important assembly leaders, including those who had children in the graduating class, weren't in attendance at the graduation. Something was happening. I took a step toward the launch pads, then shoved my hands in my jumpsuit pockets. I turned to go, but stopped. Cobb was standing there, holding a cane with a golden top. That was odd. I didn't think I'd ever seen him carry one of those. Even in his sharp white uniform, he seemed as old as a weathered boulder lying in the dust. I saluted him. I hadn't been able to face him, face any of them, since being shot down. He didn't salute back. He limped over to me, then looked me up and down.
"We going to fight this?"
"What is there to fight?" I asked, still holding the salute.
"Put your hand down, girl. You were close enough to graduation. I can challenge that you should at least be given a full pin like Arturo was."
"I'd never get to fly, so what does it matter?"
"A full pilot's pin is worth a lot in Igneous."
"This was never about a pin," I said. I looked over his shoulder at another flight launching into the air. "What's happening?"
"That shipyard you spotted should be falling out of orbit today. The Admiral is determined to get it, and if she wins this fight, there could be hundreds of new spots open for pilots. More than we can fill."
I finally lowered my hand from the salute, watching this second flight go supersonic. A sequence of distant cracks sounded in the air, rattling dishware on the refreshments table.
"Spin," Cobb said. "I didn't think you were one to—"
"I've heard the stars, Cobb." He immediately fell silent. "I saw the eyes," I continued. "A 1,000 pinpricks of white light. More, millions of them. As one, they turned to watch me. And they saw me." Cobb went white as a sheet. His hand trembled on his cane. We stood practically alone on the packed earth of the parade ground. "I have the defect," I whispered. "Like my father."
"I see."
"Was he ever erratic before that day?" I asked. "Did he show any signs before he suddenly turned and attacked you?" Cobb shook his head.
"He saw things, heard things, but nothing dangerous. Judy, Ironsides, always told him that even if the defect was real, he could overcome it. She fought for him, defended him, stuck her neck out until—"
A third flight launched. They were really committed to getting that shipyard. I looked up toward the twisting shadows of the debris field. I sighed, then unhooked the radio from my belt and handed it to Cobb. He hesitated, then took it. I could see from his worried eyes, his pale face, the truth. Knowing I'd seen those eyes, it changed his mind. He didn't want me to fly. I was too dangerous.
"I'm sorry, kid," he said.
"It's better this way," I said. "We don't have to worry about what I might or might not do." I forced out a smile, then turned from him to walk toward the refreshments. Inside, I was breaking. The person I'd been 4 months ago would never have accepted some phantom defect as an excuse to keep me from flying. But I wasn't that person anymore. I was someone else, someone who couldn't look at courage and cowardice in the simple terms that she once had. I'd ejected. I'd nearly crumpled under the weight of losing my friends. Even ignoring all of this craziness about hearing the stars, I wasn't certain I deserved to fly. It was better if I just let it all go. I lowered my head and turned away from the refreshment tables, not wanting to be around people. A hand grabbed me by the arm.
"And where do you think you're going?"
I looked up, ready to punch,
Ned?
He wore a goofy grin.
I missed the actual ceremony, didn't I? I thought for sure I'd be safe coming a few minutes late. Ironsides always talks for like 10 hours. Where's Jerkface, FM? I need to congratulate them.
They're flying a mission.
Today?
Ned said.
That's dumb. I'm supposed to wrangle them into joining us for a real party.
He seemed genuinely upset as, behind us, a fourth flight of ships rose into the air. Ned sighed, then grabbed me by the arm again.
Well, at least I can wrangle you.
Ned, I didn't make it. I ejected.
I know. That just means you won't take demerits for leaving the base for the party.
He tugged me after him.
Come on. The others are there already. Arturo's family has radio access. We can listen to the battle and cheer them on.
I sighed, but that last part was intriguing. I let him tow me off after him as a fifth flight of ships rose into the air and flew the same direction as the others. Cobb said the Admiral was going to try to salvage the shipyard, I explained, as Arturo set a large, boxy radio on our table at the restaurant, rattling the drinks. Ned and I saw at least 5 flights take off. They're serious about this. The others gathered around. It was good to see them again, and strangely refreshing not to see condemnation in their eyes. Kimmelin, Ned, Arturo. The rest of the dim restaurant was empty. Just us and a couple of younger teenagers not wearing flight pins. Probably the children of field or orchard workers.
They called in everyone, Arturo said, running a cord from the radio to the wall. Even the reserves from the lower caverns. This is going to be some fight.
Yeah, I said. I looked down at my drink and fries, neither of which I'd touched.
Hey, Kimmelin said, poking me in the side. You sulking?
I shrugged.
Good, she said. This is a day for sulking.
Graduation day, Ned said, raising his cup. For the washout club.
Hurrah,
Kimmelin said, raising hers.
You're both idiots, Arturo said, fiddling with the dials on the radio. I didn't wash out. I graduated early. Yeah?
Ned asked.
And did they call you in to fly this battle, Mr. Full Pilot, sir?
Arturo blushed. I noticed for the first time that he wasn't wearing his pilot's pin. Most everyone wore theirs every day, in uniform or not. The radio started belting out chatter, and Arturo quickly turned down the volume, then tuned it further until he landed on a channel with a firm female voice.
There we go, he said. The assembly monitoring channel. This should be a straight-up explanation of the battle for government leaders. Not the sanitized version piped down to the people listening in Igneous.
We settled in as the woman on the radio spoke. With the launch of Ivy Flight, we have 11 flights in the air and 5 scouting trios. The Saints and the North Star watch us this day as the glorious fighters of the Defiant League engage.
Ned whistled. 11. Do we have that many flights? Obviously, Arturo said. Seriously, Ned. Do you ever think before you speak? Nope.
He took a slurp of his green fizzy drink.
A man who speaks his mind, Kimmelin said solemnly, is a man with a mind to speak of.
We normally maintain 12 flights, Arturo said. 4 on duty at any given moment, usually with 1 or 2 in the air patrolling. 4 on immediate call, 4 more on deep reserve duty, protected in the lower caverns. In the past, we tried to keep them at 10 ships each, but these days we're down to 11 flights, and most of them are only 7 or so fighters strong.
87 brave pilots, the announcer continued, are making their way to engage the Krell to rescue the salvage. Victory will bring our league unprecedented glory and spoils. She had a voice like the announcers I'd listened to down below, strong but almost monotone, with an air of reading pages as they were put in front of her. This is too sterile, I said. Can we hear the real chatter? Tuned to the pilot bands? Arturo looked at the others. Ned shrugged, but Kimmelin nodded. So Arturo turned the volume down further.
We're not supposed to listen to these, he said softly.
But what will they do? Kick us out of the DDF?
He tuned a few notches until he hit the general flight leader channel.
The radios in Igneous wouldn't be able to decrypt what they were saying, but obviously Arturo's family was important enough to have a radio with an unscrambler.
"They're coming in,"
an unfamiliar voice said.
"Scud, there's a lot of them."
"Get us counts," Ironside said. "How many flights? How many ships?"
"Scouts reporting in."
I recognized that voice. It was Cloak. She was one of the scouts who had fought alongside us before.
"We'll get you numbers, Admiral."
"All active flights," Ironside said. "Stay on the defensive until we get enemy numbers. Flight command out."
I pulled my seat closer, listening to the chatter, trying to imagine the fight. A different scout described the falling shipyard, an enormous, ancient construct of steel with gaping holes and twisting corridors. Scout numbers came back. The first wave of Krell had been 50 strong, but another 50 followed. The enemy knew how important this fight was. They'd sent every ship. They were as committed as we were.
100 ships, Ned said softly. What a fight that must be.
He looked haunted. Perhaps he was remembering our chase through the bowels of the shipyard.
"That's it. They're fully committed," Ironside said. "Riptide flight, Valkyrie flight, Tungsten flight, and Nightmare flight. I want you to provide covering fire. Inner flights, keep the Krell away from that shipyard. Don't let them detonate a bomb on it."
A series of affirmatives came from the flight leaders. I closed my eyes, imagining the swarm of ships, the destructor blasts in the air. It was a relatively open battlefield, with little debris except for the one enormous shipyard. My fingers began going through motions, as if I were controlling a ship. I could feel it. The rattling of my cockpit, the rushing of the air, the flare of the booster. Saints and stars. I was going to miss it so much.
"That's a bomber," one of the flight leaders said. "I have confirmation from 3 ships.
"Scout confirmation," Cloak said. "We see it too. Flight command, a bomber is heading toward the shipyard. It's carrying a lifebuster."
"Drive it away," Ironside said. "Protecting the salvage is our most important objective."
"Yes, sir," a flight leader said. "Confirm. We push back, even if it means driving the bomber toward Alta?"
Silence on the line.
"It would take 2 or more hours of flight at bomber speeds to get within range of Alta," Ironside said.
"We'll have time to stop it before then. Orders stand."
2 hours, Ned said. "They're farther out than I thought."
"Well, bombers are about half as fast as a Poco," Arturo said. "So the shipyard is coming down around 1 hour out from us, which is about how long it took our forces to get out there. It adds up, if you think long enough to calculate it."
"Why would I have to do that?" Ned said. "When you'll do the hard work for me."
"Does anyone else feel anxious?" Kimmelin asked.
"They said a lifebuster was out there, potentially coming our way," Arturo said. "So, yeah."
"Not about that," Kimmelin said, looking at me. "About just sitting here, listening." "We should be up there," I whispered. "This is it. A battle like the Battle of Alta. They need everyone. And here we are, listening, sipping sodas."
"They've scrambled every battle-worthy ship," Arturo said. "If we were back at the DDF, we'd only be sitting around there and listening."
"We've got it on the run,"
one of the flight leaders said.
"I confirm, bomber has veered away from the salvage target. But Admiral, it is trying to break toward Alta."
"This bomber is fast," Cloak said. "Faster than most."
"Scout contingents," Ironside said. "Move to intercept. Everyone else, don't get distracted. Stay on that shipyard. This could be a decoy."
"I'm down to 3 ships, a flight leader said. "Requesting support. They're swarming us, flight command. Scud, it."
Silence.
"Valkyrie flight leader is down," someone else said. "I'm going to absorb their remaining ships. Flight command, we're taking a beating out here." "All ships," Ironside said. "Full offensive. Drive them back. Don't let them reach the shipyard."
"Yes, sir,"
a chorus of flight leaders said. The battle continued for some time, and we listened, tense.
not just because of the pilots dying trying to claim the shipyard, but because each moment of the battle, that bomber was drawing closer and closer to Alta.
Scout ships,